Okay, we are live and just getting started now. Hello, everyone. I am Abdullah Samir, as you know.
Okay, we are live.
I can hear myself. One
and
second.
Just getting started now.
Okay. Okay, awesome. Reed is with us. Okay, guys, I'm joined by Farhan Qureshi, and to get started, I guess let's both do a little quick intro. I'll go first because people are still joining, and I'm Abdullah Samir, and if you're on my channel, you obviously know who I am. Ex-Muslim. I was Muslim for 15 years. Sunni Muslim for 15 years, and I was Ismaili before that. So I was born as an Ismaili Muslim. My dad is Ismaili and my mom Sunni. And I was pretty much grew up as an Ismaili, but I had exposure to Sunni Islam as well. And sometime in my life during high school, around grade 12, I ran into some friends who kind of intrigued me to start reading the Quran. So I started reading the Quran, and I'm like, hey, this is pretty cool and it's pretty interesting. You know, I already know this is God's final word. But we don't really follow it as Ismaili. So that's kind of interesting. But yeah, I should read about it. So I started reading it. And, you know, the conclusion I came up to was Ismailism doesn't seem to match with the Quran saying, right? And as time went by, I started going to Sunni events. And then eventually I became Sunni Muslim. And eventually, I believe just like Farhan, I ended up becoming Salafi because I felt like that was the more, you know, it represented what Prophet Muhammad was following more closely. So eventually I became a Salafi, also known as a Wahhabi, but nobody calls themselves Wahhabi. People call themselves Salafi. And then that's it. And then 2 years ago in Ramadan, actually 3 years ago, I had doubts, but I kind of buried my doubts. And then 2 years ago, I actually left Islam. And ever since I left Islam, you know, I was first quiet about it, but then I felt like, you know, I want to share this, what I've figured out, and I don't want other people to spend their life on something that's not true, right? And so I said, well, you know what? Since I managed to find my way through it, through the matrix, you know, I need to tell other people and share with other people. And, you know, sometimes people ask me, like, well, how do you know you won't convert again? I don't know, whatever. Like, does that matter? Like, what's a better position? Is a better position one that you're like, yeah, I'm going to be this religion until the day I die. I don't care what evidence comes to me. I don't care what anyone tells me. I don't care that I have doubts. I don't care that these things don't make sense. I don't care. I'm just going to die as the same thing. Like, I'm just closed-minded, you know, donkey. Right? Like, that's what you want from people? You want people to be like that? Or do you want to be more like, you know, Malcolm X, that, you know what, he was in jail, he became, you know, Nation of Islam, became a heavy, bigoted racist, and then he found out that, you know what, this is not the proper Islam, so he became Muslim. And you know what, if he wasn't murdered, maybe he would have ended up like me and Farhan, right? Like, maybe he would have left Islam, who knows, right? I'm not sure. But that's a sign of an open mind, and that's a good healthy thing, that you change your mind when the evidence is presented to you. So that's what happened to me. And yeah, that's it for me. I'm now atheist, but like I said, I'm open to dialogue and I love discussing these topics. I was always interested in religion, so that's me. And Farhan, why don't you go ahead and give you a little...
Sure thing, Abdullah. First of all, thank you so much for having me and thank you so much for doing this discussion. It's an honor to finally meet you and speak with you at this length. I think that there's a lot for us to relate to. I think we both value skepticism and critical thinking and evidence and those kinds of things. And so I figured that there would be a lot to talk about and there would be a lot to relate on. In terms of, you know, leaving Islam and stuff like that, you know, I was brought up as an Ahmadi, and just like, you know, you had an upbringing in a heterodox group as well, Ismaili. And for me, it was just like you said, a lot of it was the same thing. I had to scratch my head and say, the founder of my sect is claiming to be the second coming of Jesus, right? He's claiming to be the Imam Mahdi. He's claiming to be a Mujaddid and a Nabi and a Rasul and so on and so forth. And this guy appeared in the late 1800s. And I had to ask myself, you know, one of the honest questions that I asked myself is, do I belong to a cult? you know what I mean, with the guy who's claiming to be the second coming of Jesus. Now, don't get me wrong, MDs are very nice people. They're very much nonviolent, just like Ismailis are nonviolent. And it's not about these people being nice people. It's not about them, you know, having peaceful interpretations of Islam. Is this the truth? And back then, when I was 17 years old, also in high school, I had realized that Ahmadiyyat was not Orthodox Islam, right? It wasn't consistent with Orthodox Islam. And hence, the gravitation towards Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah began to happen. Now, what's interesting with me, and I'm not sure if it's happened with you, I would definitely like your input on this, but even till this day, I will get comments on my video saying Farhan was never a Muslim. And they say it for different reasons. Like the Ali Dawah allegation against probably you is that you're a fake ex-Muslim, meaning that you were never Muslim in the sense that you didn't know the religion, right? Yeah. Something along those lines. With me, they'll say that he was Qadiani. They won't even acknowledge that I, you know, at 17 years of age, and not only embraced Khatam al-Nubuwah, but defended it because I believe that that's what the Quran and the Sunnah was teaching.
Yeah.
Right? And so from that perspective, for the many Muslims that are listening, whether they're at Hyde Park in London or, you know, many of the other Muslims that are subscribed to me and I've continuously had conversations with, they're tuning into this conversation as well. You know, you have to put yourself in our shoes, what it must have been like to be in a heterodox group and be like, wait a second, when I'm studying Islam, this isn't the true Islam. And so that's where the transition happened to orthodoxy. And to sort of wrap up where this would go, over the next 10 years, I would indulge in Sunni Islam. And I believed in Salafiyya. Why did I believe that the Salaf al-Saleh were the best to follow? Well, initially, the reason why I couldn't be Sufi, right? Considering that I'm sort of into mysticism now, why didn't I just gravitate towards tasawwuf or Sufism? And the answer to that is simple. When you're brought up in the Ahmadiyya community, you're given a very similar interpretation or understanding of Tawheed and Bid'ah and Shirk than the Wahhabis and Salafis. So the Ahmadis will say that this, all the things that the Sufis are doing is Bid'ah and Shirk and all this kind of stuff. And so it was an easy transition to embrace the Tawheed as understood by the followers of the Salaf than it was to embrace Sufism, which seemed like an alien religion to Islam.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of people don't know that.
No, I didn't know that, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, no, Ahmadis are actually against Shirk, so they would even consider what some of the things that the Shia do as Shirk, right, just like the Salafis. So you see that correlation there. So it was easier for me to embrace the Salafi community because of that interpretation, along with some other. I went to the Salafi masjid and they're much more disciplined. They could actually pronounce the Arabic, whereas the Punjabi Ahmadis could have the accent, and so all the Arabic was wrong, etc. So psychologically, the situation was so that at a very young age, 17 years of age, I would realize that the Ahmadiyya community was an attempt at reformation. Yes. To Islam, and it wasn't Islam as it was 1400 years ago. And that's basically in a nutshell. And then I left Islam 10 years later to fast forward because of hell. That was the primary reason. Logically, not just emotionally, but logically, I came to the conclusion that this doesn't make any sense based on my back. I studied psychology and science and biology. And basically on the premise of determinism, which you also made a video about, determinism versus free will. That was a significant part of why I would end up leaving Islam altogether. Yeah. But I definitely want to get into that Ali Dawah, fake Muslim, and you were never a Muslim conversation as well. But, you know, well, let's see where you want to go first and go from there.
And just to add a little bit more, you're now into spirituality. I'm hearing myself.
Spirituality. That's correct.
And Hinduism as well, right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, cool. So, okay. So about Ali Dawah, I mean, not just Ali Dawah, but the whole fake ex-Muslim thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think there's two reasons for that. The first thing is they want to, you know what, they want to maintain this illusion that nobody leaves Islam. They want to maintain this paradigm that Islam is the truth. There's millions of people converting every day. Even, you know, British young British white women are converting, you know, because apparently they put those guys on the pedestal. And it's like, you can't leave Islam, right? And if you left Islam, obviously there must be something wrong with you, because how do you leave the true religion of God, right? So I think that's what it is. It's part of the way of spinning it in such a way that nobody can leave Islam, because you were never really a Muslim in the first place. And, you know, I think people leave Islam for different reasons. And, you know, you might get some of those people that they're young and, you know, they want to party and this and that. But if you think about it, like, who put us in a cage in the first place? Who enslaved us? Who told us, you know, life is supposed to be like that? And then you wanna, like, you know, you have people in a cage, and then you wanna attack them because they wanna leave the cage. Mm-hmm. Like, really, you wanna complain because, like, they just wanna live their life? Like, that's such a shameful thing. They just wanna live their life. They just wanna have a girlfriend. Or they just wanna have a boyfriend. They just wanna have a life. Like, okay, they're such terrible people. Like shame on them for leaving Islam for that. Like, yes, I think that, you know, there's a morality thing that appeals to a lot of people. I don't know about you, but to me, I just accepted that the way I looked at it was, if Islam is true, the religion of God, then whatever it says, I have to accept. Now, how do I ascertain it's true? For me, I thought the Quran was true, and so I believed in it, I followed it, and I practiced it. So I think when I ran into Ali Dawa, it became a problem for him because I didn't fit with his, you know, what he was saying, right? And he couldn't call me a fake ex-Muslim, and I knew my stuff, right? I knew the Quran, and I could say that, no, you're wrong. Like, when he said fake ex-Muslim, and then he started calling someone else, you know, some other Muslim, oh, you're not Muslim either, I just told him, like, what about the hadith that says you shouldn't cut open people's heart, right? Like, Osama bin Zayd, you know, the beloved of Prophet Muhammad, they were fighting a war, and he killed someone, right? And he ran back, and just before they killed the guy, the guy's like, La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah. And the guy just killed him, right? They went back to the Prophet, and they told him he killed a man, and the guy said, La ilaha illallah. And Prophet Muhammad was angry, and he said, you're going to kill a man who said, La ilaha illallah. And Osama bin Zayd is like, but he just said it. He just said it to save himself, right? And so the lesson for Islam, for Muslims, is you don't judge what's in people's hearts. You know what I mean? You accept them at face value. So this is something the Muslim community needs to... And I always knew that. I never used to judge people. If someone told me they're a Muslim, I mean, you know, even if you don't think they're a Muslim, you just accept it. I mean, that's one of the Islamic values. But then you have people like Ali Dawa. It's part of his propaganda game, right? To go around calling people fake ex-Muslims, mocking ex-Muslims, you know, trying to undermine, you know, the fact that, yeah, people do leave Islam.
Absolutely. I mean, based on those standards that you get, and the thing is, it's not just Ali Dawa, right? We get comments all the time. These are people who are following through with what we can call the psychological defense mechanism in order to protect their ego, right? That they can't fathom that somebody will look at the religion of Islam and either A, say it's not for them, or B, actually study it and say, you know what, I don't believe that this is the truth behind reality.
Right.
For some reason, they can't fathom that. But the more important point, I think, is based on his standard, how many of the Muslims in the Muslim community and in these various masajid and in the overall population would be considered fake Muslims?
Yeah, because, I mean, not nominal, but like the majority of Muslims, Christians, you know, they're not scholars in orthodoxy. They're not scholars of the religion. They're just committed Muslims. Like, they may not, like, the majority of people I talk to can't defend the faith, but that doesn't mean they don't believe in it. Mm-hmm. They believe in it very strongly, and they're committed to it. They'll pray five times a day. They'll go to the masjid, right? Like, if there comes a choice in their life where they have to choose between something haram and something halal, you know, they'll always go for the halal option. Like, they strongly believe in Islam and they want to become better Muslims. They may not, you know all of the religious rulings, or they may not know everything. But at the same time, it's definitely that. And by the way, you asked me about the whole Ismaili thing. I hear that all the time. You were never a Muslim because you were Ismaili. And they just want to, like, cut out that, like, the rest of my life. They just, like, stop when I was, like, 16 or something and say, yeah, you were Ismaili. Buddy, like, I ran an Islamic website for like 15 years and had over 4 million downloads on there. I created one of the biggest Quranic websites that's still in use to this day, versebyverseQuran.com. And like that just, that doesn't show that I knew the religion. That just shows that I believed in it and I was committed to it, right? So yeah, I mean, I think we, people like me and you are, you know, trying to change the narrative now, because the narrative cannot continue like this. Like, it's just people that know Islam and speak about it now as ex-Muslims, or my friend Reason on Faith, who is also an ex-Ahmadiyya, just like yourself, are really changing the game now, right?
Totally. I mean, I don't think that there's a lot of people who have come out. You know, I was looking to see how many, you know, ex-Muslim YouTubers there are, and there's like less than a handful. And so, you know, there's a way that more people can speak up. But I think that there's a lot of people who watch your videos and watch, you know, my videos and the other ex-Muslims on there, and they're really looking for these voices to speak up for them because they don't have the confidence or bravery to do so. And so I think that there's going to be more and more people who are brave enough, who have the knowledge to be able to come on and challenge these narratives. And it's just a matter of time. This is the millennial generation, bro. This is like the beginning of it. And the most of the people who are these traditionalists who want to hold on to the traditions, whether it's American traditionalism, right? Look at what happened. I don't want to get into politics, but look at what's happening all across the world. The traditionalists, the baby boomers who are on their way out, are basically struggling to keep their traditions alive. You know what I mean? And they're electing these politicians into office that will help preserve their traditions, whether it's French tradition, American tradition, Muslim tradition, Arab tradition, Indian tradition. The baby boomers like, no, we got to protect these traditions. And I value tradition too, obviously, but tradition isn't the main thing that we have. We also have science, we have logic, and there's multiple ways to look at the nature of reality, you know, considering all the information that we have. You know, in terms of, you know, the websites that you ran, Light Upon Light, I definitely benefited from that website a lot. And a matter of fact, when I came out with my video, My Journey from Islam to Hinduism, I used a video of Bilal Phillips, and it has Light Upon Light written on the bottom as a, you know, that this is where the video is from. So that was pretty cool. I know, but I definitely benefited a lot from your website. I know that you were, you know, you genuinely believed in the Muslim narrative, and now you don't. Yeah. And, you know, another thing that I want to say before I get your insight is, what's interesting is that Ali Dawa was an Alawi.
Yeah.
Right? You know? I don't know too much about the kid. I do know that. And so he's still young. I don't know how old he is. And granted, even if he gets married, the idea is that if reality happens to hit in the future and he leaves Islam, was he never a Muslim?
Yeah.
And that possibility is there, because look at Yasir Qadhi and I just want to use Yasir Qadhi and Hamza Yusuf as an example of how they shifted. Granted, they didn't leave Islam, but you look at them from where they were in the beginning to where they are now, they're completely different people. Yeah. They're completely, even Shabir Ali would not say some of the things that he says now. That he wouldn't have said those things 10 years ago. I wouldn't have heard that.
Yeah, totally. And another thing I just thought of is, it's crazy how many ex-Muslims are in the closet, like the all around us. Like I actually made a post on my Facebook saying, yeah, I know a bunch of ex-Muslims were Hafiz, but I was actually surprised that there was quite a few of them. And it started with like three, and I kept getting private messages. It's like four now, five, six, seven. I'm like, I actually know more people that memorize the Quran that are ex-Muslim now than I know Muslims that have memorized the Quran. I'm like, whoa, this is crazy. Like, I wasn't expecting that. And it doesn't mean if you memorize the Quran, you're a scholar. Again, it shows a commitment, though. It shows a commitment, and it shows that you were an integral part of that community, your family, you know. And the cost is just too high for some people to openly leave Islam. One of them is the fear factor. So, you know, I have to thank, you know, MTS, Shams in UK. By the way, I also got your video sent to me by a friend when I first left Islam. Maybe even before I made my own video, he sent me a video, and I won't mention his name because he's in the closet still. But he sent me a video and he said, check this guy out. And I was like, I watched an interview with you, and it was like, yay, this is pretty cool. This guy has gone through a similar journey, and I'm glad you reached out to me now so we're talking. But yeah, it's crazy. Like, I think the cost is just way too high for most people to openly leave Islam. You know, in many cases, the risking the wife. Like, I know a couple of men that told me, you know, they're scared the wife will leave them. Not necessarily because of the wife. It could be because of the father-in-law and mother-in-law. They'll just jump in and say, you can't be married to this apostate, and you have to divorce him. And even if there's kids involved or no kids involved. Some of them, they kind of, like, the parents-in-law, like one guy I'm thinking of now, his wife's parents kind of know, because the guy's, like, kind of questioning them sometimes. But he won't just come out and say, like, I'm not Muslim, right? He can't, right? And I know a couple of people as well that work in the Muslim community doing service-based businesses. So they're self-employed. They have their own businesses. Again, I can't say where they are. But they can't come out because, again, like, they would be just cut off from the community, right? So there's quite a few reasons why, because I think we're missing, you know, we're missing a key ingredient, which is tolerance in the Muslim community. And so, you know, people like myself, it comes with a very big expense to come out. And like, what do you gain? Like, you everybody cuts you off. Everybody kind of disowns you. You know, it's like a very big personal cost. In my case, you know, it's not as bad because my family is liberal. You know, I was careful with my wife in the beginning. I wanted to see how she would react. And I made a video on that and I explained that in the beginning, I put it as doubts. And then eventually, you know, she was able to see that I was sincere in what I was saying. And I went to talk to the wherever I could find a couple of imams, knowledgeable friends who studied in Medina. One of my friends who teaches at an American university, teaches Islam, you know, at an academic, to whoever I could to try to, you know, find my way back into Islam. I just couldn't. I couldn't find a way to make sense of, I couldn't find a reason to believe in Islam again. I just couldn't believe. And you can't choose belief, right? Like, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. You can't. Like, once you perceive a certain reality, either you're going to be a hypocrite and profess something contrary to what you're perceiving to be true, or you're going to be bold enough to say, you know what, this is what I think, this is what I perceive, and I'm going to be true to what I believe, I perceive to be, you know, authentic when it comes to information. And I think that you did that totally, Abdullah. You know, there's a lot of ex-Muslims out there where you can probably question their narrative about why they left Islam. Was it a good reason, right? Mm-hmm. They may have had reasons that weren't the best of reasons to leave Islam. But who cares about that too, right? They want to leave Islam. They didn't like it, whatever. You know, maybe they were culturally affected by a family that, you know, happened to be Muslim, and they associated some of the conservative values that were oppressing them with Islam. And maybe that was the fault of a faulty interpretation of Islam according to Muslims. But that doesn't matter. The reason why it doesn't matter is because yeah, they've been through what they've been through, and to some degree, they felt that the religion was limiting them.
And by the way, that's another point. When someone leaves Christianity and becomes Muslim, nobody says, oh, you know, he left Christianity for a bad reason because, you know, or she left Christianity for a bad reason because, you know, hijab liberated her and now she's covering herself. Nobody says she didn't, like, study Christianity enough. It's like when you leave another religion, you become Muslim, the standards are so low. You don't have to even know anything about Islam. You just have to know that, you know, yeah, this is Islam. You know a little bit about it and you accept Islam. But it's kind of a unfair standard that when you want to leave Islam, suddenly it's like the bar is up to, like you can never reach that bar of actually being Muslim enough to really know Islam to leave it.
100%. I really hope, you know, I'm definitely going to share this video with some of the Muslim scholars that I've been, you know, engaging with, because this is something that they don't seem to understand either, that nobody can genuinely leave Islam. There's some type of confusion, there's delusion, there's something wrong with this person. You know, there has to be what Ali Dawah says, it's all an emotional reason. Let me tell you this. You know, when he converted to Islam, was there no emotional component to why he converted? There's an emotional component to every conversion, to every religion, and to every deconversion. You can't separate emotion. But what you can do is that besides the emotional component to why people switch for whatever reason, is there a logical basis? Is it evidence-based? Is this person leaving Islam because he doesn't want it to be true? Or is this person leaving Islam because genuinely he looked at the religion, he looked at the information and said that this is
and
not.
Can I just jump in there?
Definitely.
So here's another thing. Why do you have to have a reason to leave Islam? Why is it that the default position is Islam is true and you need to justify why you should leave it? You know what I'm saying? It's like already the narrative is skewed. It's like, what, like, you know, when people come to me and they say, well, what are the doubts you had in the Quran? And if I convince you, would you become Muslim again? It's like by default, this is true. And let me just fix the little things that you have an issue with. And, you know, we'll find a way to make you, you know, kind of gloss over those things. Yeah, you have an issue with Prophet Muhammad, what he did here. You have an issue with slavery. Yeah, let's just gloss over that. And let's just make a, you know, some explanation about why, you know, they needed to do that. And it's okay. And this and that. And then after all of it, you're left with this kind of like, you know, kind of uncomfortable feeling that, yeah, there's this doubt and this doubt. But like, let's go back to square one. Why should I believe it in the first place? Like, what's the reason to believe? Like, it's not like, you know, the problem is all of us are born Muslim. We're born into Muslim families, majority of us, or we converted, some of us. And by default, the position is just assumed that Islam is true. And now you need to poke holes in it. But that's the wrong way of looking at it. And this is something I've learned recently. We shouldn't look at it like that. We should ask, why should I believe in it? Not why should I tell you why I don't believe in it? You tell me why I should believe in it. Let's go back to the basis. Let's go back to the fact that Prophet Muhammad, he came and he said he spoke to God. Okay. If anyone comes to you and tells you they spoke to God, would you believe them? Well, I probably wouldn't, but let's hear some more. Like, okay, what's the next thing? Yeah, he came up with a book and you know, he doesn't have any miracles, but he has this book. Okay, he has a book. I have books too. Yeah, but this book is a cool book. Yeah, okay, it's cool. Why is it cool?
Why is Abdullah, you're beginning to cut off, and I don't think it's my signal, it's yours. Abdullah. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I think Abdullah Samir is having some connection problems. So we're going to be on standby. So what I'm going to do, I think that it's his connection and not the Google Live and that I'm probably coming on. So what I'll say is this, in terms of what Abdullah is saying that, you know, do people need to have reasons to leave a religion? I agree wholeheartedly with him. If their temperament or and their level of interest and their level of knowledge does not match what Islam is offering to them, meaning that it's not compatible with their temperament and in their knowledge and their perspective, then they shouldn't be obligated to follow Islam, consider Islam, or what have you. If they choose to consider Islam, you know, that's their choice. And I think, you know, Muslims will agree with that. They'll say, La ikraha fi din. There is no compulsion in religion. But then yet at the same time, when you say that there's no compulsion, there's this threat of an eternal hellfire that if you choose to leave the religion, or that if you choose to, you know, avoid this evidence, then you will be held accountable. Not only will you be held accountable, but you will be tortured in fire for eternity as a result. And so when we look at the implications of the Muslim narrative, you know, and why they're requiring, you know, ex-Muslims to be scholars in order to leave Islam, you know, it doesn't make much sense. So in order to continue this conversation, I'm going to need Abdullah. So what I'm going to do is take a quick break, and we will be back. Hey, Abdullah. Okay, hey, that, you know, yeah, if you lost connection, that's, oh, you're coming back or? Okay, sure. Take your time. It says waiting for people to join the video call and that we're live. Yep. All right, cool.
Hello, sorry everyone got disconnected for a momentary second. Internet connection is, hello.
Yeah.
I'll be back. Fahan, you can hear me?
Yeah, we are back.
Sorry about that. I don't know what happened. My internet just died. Where were we?
So yeah, I mean, you know, we were talking originally about whether, you know, a person needs to know Islam or be a follower of Islam in order to leave it. And, you know, even if you're not going to be a scholar of it, do they have to have a reason to leave Islam?
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Or if just because it's true by default, according to.
Right. And I just to jump in again, I'm speaking with Farhan Qureshi. His channel is Orthodox786 on YouTube. Please subscribe to him. He's a former Muslim, just like myself, and he's had quite a journey. And he has quite some interesting videos on spirituality that I'm hoping to check out. Mindfulness, you know, different things like that. And his journey from Islam. You know, we've been through quite a similar journey, and we're having a discussion now about faith. You know, people that question ex-Muslims, and they question that whether we were actually ex-Muslim, and, you know, the heavy cost that people go through when they leave Islam openly. And I do hope that, you know, more and more people that leave Islam openly will give people more courage to do so and to change the narrative that you can't leave Islam. And I think the Muslim community has started responding to it already in some way, like with the Yaqeen Institute, you know, Jonathan Brown, Asadullah Ali. And these guys, they're trying to, you know, Omar Suleiman, they're trying to make, you know, topics, arguments against evolution, against, you know, the main issues that people are having with Islam, they're trying to, you know, get to them. And but the thing is, with me, a lot of these things like evolution, the morality issues, I never thought about them as even when I left Islam. The main issue for me was the Quran not reflecting the reality as it seemed. And then when I started to look into it, the stories all being, you know, related to Middle Eastern apocrypha, like, you know, stories that have been kind of circulated around in the area. And, you know, the more I looked into it, the more I saw connections between Zoroastrianism and, you know, Islam. And then the more I looked into it, the more I saw that everything in the Quran was based on what Prophet Muhammad could have known, you know, like, some things are so silly in the Quran. Like, for example, the Quran says the Jews say that Uzair is the son of Allah. Nobody I know ever said this, ever knew this. No Jew I know. So it's just like, it's like a complete I wouldn't even call it a fabrication. It was just Muhammad including things that he would have seen around him. And that's exactly what we see in the Quran, right?
Same thing with Mary being in the Trinity and, you know, Mary being in the Trinity and stuff like that. No, I agree. The Prophet Muhammad, like you said in one of your videos, was a man of his time. He was a 7th century Arab in a particular circumstance, in a particular religious atmosphere. The Kaaba was making a ton of money, right? There was interest in getting that Kaaba to make money. It's like, no, I'm joking. I don't think.
It's true. Actually, you know what? Like, there's a certain, you know, there's a certain threshold of, how do I say this? there's a certain leeway that Muslims will give you between the orthodox official story of Islam and how far you stray from that. So if you start saying things like, was Muhammad really in Mecca or was he in Petra? And then you bring forward some evidence for this. Now, because it's so far out, people start thinking you're crazy. It's like, this guy's gone crazy, right? And if you say like, yeah, like Allah was actually a pre-Islamic, you know, deity. And yes, there's lots of evidence for that. Like Abdullah was a father of Allah. And when you say things like there's no connection between Allah and, you know, Christianity and Judaism, it's just, it was reappropriated by Muhammad to, you know, like it was rebranded, right? The Kaaba was rebranded as a house of God when it was actually a house of idol worship in the middle of Arabia.
It always there's no evidence that Ishmael and Abraham ever built the Kaaba. It is a pagan temple. All of the rituals in Mecca are pagan.
Yeah.
All of the Meccan rituals are pagan.
Yeah, and then,
it was never Abrahamic.
And then there's some which are like very, very clear. You know, as a Muslim, I used to scratch my head. Like the four sacred months, right? And it's like the fact that foster children are haram. It's like, you know, somebody thought that breast milk, you know, influenced the blood and so it made it haram. Like if you breastfeed from the same lady, suddenly it becomes like incest, right? Mm-hmm. If you marry that lady. And so Prophet Muhammad, he actually made this one man divorce his wife because, you know, these guys are happily married, this man and his woman, and some lady comes and said, I breastfed both of you guys. And then so they went to the Prophet, and the Prophet said, divorce her. So she's your foster sister. Like, tell me something. Like, how does that work? Like, if someone, I might have drank from the same cow as you. Does that, you know what I mean? Does that mean we're like brothers now? Like, the cow is a mom or something? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it makes no sense, eh?
And no, some of the hadith, yeah. I mean, even Muslims have a difficult time with that. I don't know if you've seen some Muslims trying to deal with, for example, the Satan in your nose type of hadith. Yeah,
but hold on, this is in the Quran.
Yeah, the milk, right.
The foster siblings, you can't marry the foster sibling. You know, it's in Surah Nisa, where, you know, it lists all of the words haram to you. Your mother is haram, your sister is haram, the ones who suckled from the same mother haram, you know, your foster siblings, your foster mother, even your foster mother. So, I mean, I kind of get the foster mother thing, but like foster siblings just seems like really, it seems very culturally, you know, defined, you know, like, you know. And but the thing is, what I was saying was when you start to mention to Muslims, like, you know, what you just said, that the Kaaba is a house of idol worship and it was never connected to Christianity and Judaism, they suddenly think you're like some conspiracy theorist and that you're crazy and you're just, you know, following Christian preachers and you don't have a brain. Like, they can't even fathom that this is possible. They don't realize that in Saudi now, like, all of the evidence is being destroyed as we speak. Like, they are not, like, shouldn't they, if this is such a historical, amazing place, shouldn't they be inviting, like, archaeologists and, you know, those type of scientists to come in and to discover the history of Arabia? But instead, it's like, bulldoze it, destroy it. And I know Sufis are against this, but I don't think it's just because of the Wahhabi. I think that they know, like, if you watch that video, The Sacred City, by Dan Gibson, he actually goes and he talked to somebody who remained anonymous in Saudi who acknowledges that they know that something's not quite right with the official story. And, you know, it's in the best interest to continue to be the official house of Allah, right? I mean, what is it, $8 billion a year in revenue they get from Hajj?
Easily.
So it's, yeah. Like, yeah, it makes sense they want to hide that, right?
Right. And that's always been the history of the Kaaba. You know, obviously the amount that people get as a result of it has changed. I do want to make a quick correction. I don't think that Prophet Muhammad was primarily interested in profiting off of this. He wasn't in it.
Oh, yeah.
Right? He was even offered the keys to the Kaaba. So I was joking earlier that subconsciously there may have been a business, you know, motive. No, I don't think that's honestly that's the case. Although that definitely came with the Muslims conquering Mecca and so on and so forth.
What do you think was his, like, this is a question I get asked all the time. It's a really difficult question. Sure. Do you want to talk about it?
Go for it.
What do you think is his motive?
Yeah, what so here's my honest, this is what I think, honestly, and I could be wrong, right? And I honestly think that he was having mystical experiences, whether in the cave and even in childhood. These mystical experiences definitely caused him to believe that he was communicating with something outside of this world. And as I think that he was primarily motivated by that. Ali Sina, who is an atheist, well, he was an atheist. He ex-Muslim, became an atheist, and now he's spiritual, right? So Ali Sina had that transition too, which is interesting. But he wrote in his book that that he hypothesized that this was temporal lobe epilepsy, right? And he gathered a bunch of different symptoms from the hadith that matched the symptoms of temporal lobe epilepsy. If he was having temporal lobe epilepsy, which is a reasonable hypothesis, then a lot of what he would be saying and doing would make sense. So do I think that he believed in his narrative? Yes. Do I think that his congregation fed into the narrative? Yes. Do I think Waraka fell into the narrative, and Khadija and his support fell into his what he was experiencing and confirming it for him? Yes. So I do think that he was genuine in his motive, and that's just my perspective.
Okay. Yeah, and for me, I think that's an okay position, because to be honest, I don't think we can really know for sure what his motive was. And I do believe that the temporal lobe epilepsy makes a lot of sense. You know, Dr. Lamchan, I don't know if I pronounced his name right.
Yes.
He's talked about this as well. And, you know, there's a sheikh, his name is, he's not a sheikh. He's a neuroscientist. He's a student of philosophy and science. And his name is Dr. Muhammad Ghilan. And he actually mentions, he has a video, which I'm hoping to make a video out of it, where he talks about prophethood and how in the neuroscience field, they say that you can understand prophethood perfectly using neuroscience. Because what happens is you get this, there's people that they have this temporal lobe epilepsy and they think they're talking to God, right? And they start believing it. And who knows, like, you can actually delude yourself. Some of the things in the seerah make me wonder, like, you know, you don't know how deep it goes, right? Like, you know, I actually do believe in a sense that God is like a super ego, and, you know, it's us projecting our desires onto this, you know, greater being that's going to take care of us, that's going to fulfill all of our needs, that's going to, like, protect us and save our children, you know, reunite us with our family. So I feel like that's kind of like, you know, if you get too deep in a rabbit hole, it becomes that you are God in a sense. And whatever you want, God wants you to have that, right? Like when the verse in the Quran comes and says, you know, oh, you will believe, you know, send your peace and blessings on Muhammad, because every time you do that, God will send peace and blessings on you. It's like almost like he's, you know, God's become his superego. And some of the things in the seerah do make me, you know, kind of doubt his integrity. Like things like, you know, getting married to Zainab, just, you know, like he fell in love with her and then he just walked into her house like, hey, Zainab. And she's like, what are you doing in my house? And he's like, I'm your husband now. And she's like, you're my husband? Yeah. She's like, yeah, Allah married me to you. And, you know, and there was no nikah ceremony. And it's just an instant marriage from God. God just married her, right? And it's like some of the special exceptions he kept getting, you know, when he told his family, when he told his companions that God told me to tell you guys, get out of my house, don't come too early, and don't leave too late. You know, I'm shy to tell you, but God's not shy to tell you. So there's a few things in the seerah that make me kind of suspect, you know, him getting 1/5 of all of the royal booty, khums, which Shia to this day, they still continue that. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Like, you know what I mean? It doesn't matter what his intentions were, whether they were pure or whether he was self-deluded. We'll never know. It was so long ago. I think people like you were willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, get a lot of flack for that, right? You get like totally beaten up, like when you say that, like you get this, you get all the bigots like, I want to strangle you for saying that. Takiya, fake ex-Muslim. You got Ali Dawa guys like saying fake ex-Muslim. And then you got these Takiya guys, these like, you know, sadly, most of them tend to be Christian. Bigots that they're like, Takiya, you know, fake ex-Muslim, you're actually Muslim. So it's like, this way, I don't know, where am I?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. I don't think that it benefits us to assume whatever Muhammad's motivations were. Muhammad is who he was.
Exactly.
And he is a part of our history. He is a part of our collective narrative. He's impacted the world in profound ways, good or bad. but he's a part of our collective narrative and we have to deal with it. And, you know, each of us deal with it differently. Me personally, obviously, I value subjectivity. I value mystical experiences. So I don't take that away from Prophet Muhammad as much as I don't take it away from, you know, John Doe across the street. You know, if a person has a subjective experience, that's what they experience. That's what's real to them. Doesn't mean that it's ultimately real or objectively real, but we don't know what subjectivity is. We don't know, understand its role or its significance overall, and we are agnostic about it. And I use the word agnostic because, you know, the perspective that I take now, the Hindu perspective, God is not about being out there. It's about recognizing, you mentioned the superego. It's about recognizing the divine within and within yourself and the divine within everything. Could we be deluded as well from a psychological standpoint? Absolutely. But it's also possible that a person who is too skeptical and conforms to materialism, that they are just as, in theory, if there is an ultimate reality and there's a spiritual reality, there's some type of reality outside of materialism, then the person who subscribes to materialism would be deluded. So delusion goes all the way around depending on how much the person convinces themselves of their narrative. I try to be, like we said in the beginning, as open-minded as possible. Open-minded skeptic is what Joe Rogan calls it. I don't know if you listen to Joe Rogan. Big fan of both Joe Rogan and Sam Harris. Huge fan of both of those individuals. But the conversation that Joe Rogan and Sam Harris have are much better conversations for me than conversations that, you know, that Sam Harris would have with a pure materialist, because a pure materialist to me is could theoretically be as delusional as somebody who's a pure, you know, mystic who just believes in everything metaphysical and doubts.
You know, sorry, I'm not familiar with Joe Rogan. Can you tell me who he is?
Oh, Joe Rogan he does a podcast. He's famous. He commentates for the UFC.
Okay.
That's where he's mostly known for is being a commentator for the UFC, but he's a comedian, a stand-up comic. He's done some documentaries, other TV shows. He's pretty famous. I would definitely recommend his four or five conversations with Sam Harris now. Speaking of Sam Harris, I'm one of my other favorite podcasts with him is, with a person that, Introverted Smile had actually mentioned on his YouTube channel, Jordan Peterson. Now, Jordan Peterson interprets Christianity the way that I interpret Hinduism.
Oh, so you're the Jordan Peterson. Okay, I know Jordan Peterson. I've watched a bunch of his stuff.
Okay. So you're familiar with like psychology and archetypes and Jungian archetypes and how these archetypes play into our mythos. So we were talking about mythology and all these stories in the Quran and the Bible and all this stuff. Where do they come from? You know, why are these stories of heroes and villains so similar across the board? Joseph Campbell has done a ton of research on this, Carl Jung. And so Jordan Peterson has taken the paradigm of that, the structures of the mind that are ultimately, you can't measure these structures, but we can talk about them and measure them to the degree of reports, you know, the case studies and reports of individuals. So there's structures of the mind, there's archetypes that happen to play into multiple narratives across the board, across culture and throughout history. And so Jordan Peterson has an interesting interpretation of mythology, of spirituality, of religion, of Christianity. And I happen to take an identical approach when it comes to Hinduism. Okay.
Interesting. Yeah. I did listen to the podcast with him and Sam Harris, and I watched one of his videos. I couldn't quite get to the bottom of like, the thing I didn't like about what he was saying was he does a lot of fear-mongering about materialism. And he says, you know, if he just, and maybe he's right, I don't know, but I haven't seen that his claims are substantiated. Like, he feels that if he stopped believing in God, like, society will basically collapse upon itself. And he builds this on top of the Christian kind of, you know, family, nuclear family idea that this is the best type of family to have. And then he kind of puts Christianity on a pedestal, in a sense, I feel. And then he says that, you know, and he mentions the story of people that the story of this guy that didn't believe in God, like he killed someone, and I don't remember the details. But the point is, he worries that without, you know, going back to this ultimate truth of God, there's no reason to be moral anymore. Like, do you know what I'm talking about? Like, he kind of fears that without religion or this sort of religious kind of idea of this ultimate truth, mm-hmm. that we will end up like killing each other, stealing. There's no reason not to steal, no reason not to murder. Have you heard this from him? Like, did you?
Yeah,
did you
I've heard of this argument. I've heard this argument from Muslims even.
Oh yeah, Muslims all the time. I mean, right. And I haven't seen it to be true, because when you look at Iceland and you look at places which have a high level of agnosticism or atheism, they're doing quite well. Some of them, they've even closed the jails, and we find the opposite when it comes to the religiosity mm-hmm. in, for example, America versus, you know, less religious countries, you know, and even when you've you know, accounted for like wealth, you find that the ones which are more religious tend to have higher crime rates. You know, people that believe in free will mm-hmm. tend to also, you know, it tends to be that the same type of people that also believe in free will also are more punitive in the punishments. They want to punish people rather than reforming them. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, I think me and you would agree that, you know, coming from a, I think you agree with me on about the whole free will thing, right? That mm-hmm. that we're just doing, you know, kind of like what we're kind of going to do. And for that reason, it's better not to punish people, but to try to reform them. And, you know, sometimes you have to keep them away from society and you have to protect society from those people. Yes. But we don't want to punish them for the sake of punishment. And that's why the whole idea of hell is so nonsensical, because we're genetically programmed towards certain things. We have certain desires. People that are like extreme examples of this would be like, you know, narcissists or psychopaths. They're just doing what the brain is telling them to do. They didn't say, I'm going to go and kill someone. And they're not like me and you. They don't have that switch in the brain telling them, stop, stop, stop. Like, you know, I feel guilty even like picking up a dollar on the street and like, am I stealing? Like, it's just like hardwired inside me. And I used to wonder, like, as a Muslim, if I'm not Muslim, would I still be like that? And yeah, pretty much. Like, you know, I pick up an umbrella on the train and I go and drop it off to Lost and Found. Why? Not because I'm a good guy, but because these values evolved inside of us, right? Towards, you know, so obviously there's always the minority, which are the psychopaths, which they have the genes are different. But like, you know, this type of thing, this type of behavior has been refined over the years. Just like with monkeys, you know, we see monkeys have some basis for, you know, you can, I don't know if you call it morality or not, but like they'll get angry if they get an unfair, you know, treat. They'll deny themselves food if they know that the other monkey is going to get shocked or beaten. You know, they'll sacrifice, you know, a monkey will sacrifice its food for an older female. You know, elephants will, you know, we see some rudimentary morality in animals even. And it's obviously more refined in humans. But like, it's not like I chose to be a good person. I just am, in the sense of like, I have that guilt and I have that fear. You know what I'm saying? I'm not scared God's going to punish me. No one's going to punish me if I steal that umbrella on the train. And sometimes maybe I'll just take it because, you know what? No one's going to come and get it anyways. But the point is, you get what I'm saying?
No, 100%. Both in terms of morality and determinism, I'm following your argument completely. Let's start with the morality question about what Jordan Peterson was saying, that if without religion, that we would all end up moral. I agree with you, Abdullah. I agree with you. I think that we are hardwired. I think in our evolution throughout time, we are who we are, and we have empathy. It's a part of us in the frontal lobe. Sociopaths don't have that part of their brain as working as properly. And so, no. So you're correct. What I would say is that and from the Hindu perspective too, it's not about a belief in God, whether you believe or subscribe to a belief in God or not. What you're supposed to go through and what you're going through is what's going to happen, right? And you are to learn the lessons from whatever it is that you're going through. Now, these lessons are practical lessons. You can look back on your life and learn from some of the mistakes you've made, learn from some of the triumphs that you've had. So in that sense, it's logical and practical that, you know, it's not about subscribing to a belief that then makes you moral, but rather naturally being moral. Is something that is totally there. What I would say though, with regards to determinism and morality and a lack of belief in God, where I could possibly agree with Jordan Peterson in the context of determinism without free will, is that if humanity begins to believe that there's no purpose in life, that this is pointless, this is just life and death, that nothing else matters, then that's going to have social implications. And then from social implications, for example, for right now, we love to advertise sex, drugs, alcohol, partying, those kinds of things in society. And when children grow up into that society, they're going to be attracted to it. That leads to addictive behaviors, behavioral patterns that are difficult to turn around. You know, in mental health and psychology, we're trying to turn around these behavior patterns. And what we're learning is that these people, these individuals, are getting caught up into these addictive patterns because of the environments that they're in. And the thing is, if human beings can cultivate an environment that is disciplined, cultivate an environment that teaches things like meditation and mindfulness so that you can control yourself, so that you don't give in to these addictions and impulses, then that would be a society that would be morally better than a society that is a society of anarchy, a society of shoving immorality down our throats and making it look attractive, and then leading to mental health problems. The mental health problems in America and in the world are severe. People underestimate the mental health problems, and people underestimate where these mental health problems are coming from. They're rooted in moral situations. And so morality is important, and we need to have a sense of morality. Sam Harris would agree with that. If you read The Moral Landscape, he believes in objective morality. Not all atheists do. Many atheists are nihilists. And so it all depends on how you look at this situation.
Right. Yeah, you're right. That's what it is. Right? It's a fear of nihilism. And I think that's part of what Jordan Peterson is getting at, isn't it?
Yeah, that's his fear. I'm personally not afraid, because I think that the human condition has it so that even if we end up becoming immoral, there will always be a portion of the population that will bring it back. Same thing with between liberalism and conservatism. I'm a liberal, but I have some conservative values. I think if we become too liberal, that moral landscape might lead towards that addictive mental health problem scenario that we're looking at. But then that's where the new wave of conservatism will come and challenge that liberalism that is soon to take over across the world. Baby boomers are on their deathbed. And when liberals and millennials and postmodern millennials take over, it's going to lead to a lot of moral situations in the world that are going to be detrimental. From my opinion, right. I might be.
And how do we fight nihilism? What is the meaning? If there's no Jannah, there's no Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, where do we find meaning in life?
Right. So that's going to be, that's where meaning in life, from an atheist skeptical point of view, and as well from the Dharmic and mystical traditions, is subjective, right? There is an objective component to morality and crime and stuff like that. But in terms of meaning of life, that's going to be subjective. And everybody's going to have different lessons and different perceptions.
Do you feel nihilism? Like, I had a friend, one of my friends, again, I wish I could mention his name, but he had, like, once he left, okay, so for me, I didn't have that issue. Once I left Islam, I'm like, okay, it's not true, whatever, right? And I moved on in my life, and I'm living my life, and I'm happy, and I'm doing what I need to do, I'm working, I'm taking care of my kids, with my family, and my life is still good. He had some severe challenges, and I've heard this happen over and over again. Some people, like, lose faith in life. Have you seen this before? Like they're like, what's the purpose now? There's no God. Who's going to take care of my kids? Like, and they struggle with that for a long time. I mean, my friend actually overcame it, and he's quite happy now. But for a long time, he was struggling with his life after he lost Islam.
Right. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, with regards to your question, do I fear nihilism? I mean, I wouldn't use the word fear. I think that it is, because I don't think that it will ever take over.
Okay.
I don't think it's going to ever happen, but I would fear it in the sense that, given the reality of determinism, if human beings really don't have free will, and we have in our animal nature is very much a part of us, then yes, crime would go haywire. You know, what's that movie called, where everybody has like a day to do all the crime that they want to do? Come on. Yeah, this is on the tip of, see, I teach psychology, so this is the tip of the tongue phenomenon. We can't it's the name of the movie, but you can't remember it.
It's an interesting point that you said that you teach psychology, you said?
Yeah, I do.
Nice.
Psychology 101 adjunct. I'm not like a PhD or anything.
Awesome. But you know what's interesting? Psychology was one of my most, one of my favorite classes at university. So I studied computer science, but I took a lot of soft classes. So psychology, anthropology, and I actually did like I think it was almost like a minor in psychology. And it's interesting that, you know, when you compare engineers and, you know, artsies, there's a difference. There's a big difference. And engineers tend to see the world in black and white. And as well, you know, there's actually a correlation. It's kind of funny. There's a correlation between engineers and terrorists. It doesn't mean that if you're, it's not a causation. You know, it's not like you study engineering, you become a terrorist. It's like the type of people that tend to be engineers also tend to be falling into terrorism, which is interesting when you see the world in black and white. And me and you, I can see that we connect, and we don't think of the world like that. And I think that's why, maybe that's why you found your way out of Islam. And maybe that's why I found my way out of Islam. Like, it's kind of like a big picture perspective on life, on psychology. Like, even as a Muslim, you know, when it came to homosexuals, I always used to wonder, like, I know they don't choose to be that way, right? It's like, nobody chooses a sexuality. Like, I mean, you are what you are. It's yes, there's a spectrum of sexuality between, you know, homosexuality and being straight, but it's not something you choose. It's just what you have. It's just what you're given, right? And the existence of gay Muslims that hate being gay is complete evidence that they do not choose to be gay. And so, you know, things like that, they kind of used to make me wonder, as, you know, this kind of open-minded person, even as a Muslim, I subscribe to the fact that, yes, homosexuality is haram and, you know, it's not allowed and it's sin and whatever. But at the same time, you know, this kind of broad picture perspective on psychology and life, I think that helps you. And that helps people to see past, you know, falling into, you know, false ideas, because you're kind of broad-minded. And I think this is the reason why there's a connection between engineers and terrorists. I love engineers. I have a lot of engineers in my family. I'm not saying that anything bad about engineers. It's just a different way of looking at the world. It's a very mechanical way, right? And yeah. Of course, there's different mixes of people too. Not all engineers are like that, right? Just to add a disclaimer.
You know, I mean, I think that if anybody genuinely studies biology, studies evolution, studies psychology, studies sociology, studies, you know, studies reality, the nature of reality from a scientific point of view, from a logical and philosophical point of view, and even adds the component of valuing subjectivity, you can't believe most of the things that a lot of people believe in when it comes to you know, Christianity, Islam, especially. And, you know, I think that more and more people are waking up to this. But you know, the more people that we find that are waking up and are being open-minded skeptics, and just kind of, you know, we're agnostic about a lot of things, but I'm open-minded type of mentality, you know, that's beginning to surface. But when you really look out the world, there's still endless Muslims and Christians everywhere, and they still own and manage and govern the world that we're in. And so, but in our lifetimes, if you and I survive, you know, if you continue to live a full life, in our lifetime, we will see the baby boomers go away. Yeah. So in our lifetime, we will see that generational shift take place.
And you know what? Like, I think that if secularism becomes more dominant, it becomes less of an issue whether someone is Muslim or Christian or Jewish or whatever, atheist, because as long as the laws protect everyone to have equal rights, I actually support Muslims who want to, like, and I'm sure you do too, because I can see we think very similarly. Support Muslims who want to pray, fast, do their own thing. I have no problem with it, absolutely no problem. I will fight for the rights of Muslims to be Muslim, but of course their rights end with someone else's rights begin. And that's what secularism is, and that's why I believe secular liberal democracies are the best way for society that we've found so far, right? I mean, we might come up with something better in the future, I don't know. But like, so far, this is the best that we have, and I think this is why we need to support it. Islamic fascism, Christian theocracy, none of these things is good for society. It's not good for humanity, it's not good for people, it's not good for families, it's not good for women, it's not good for homosexuals. it's not good for it's just good for people at the top, maybe. I don't know. But, you know, this is why I think we need to support secularism. And so, you know, even if everyone still wants to follow, you know, still wants to worship God, I actually support you. Worship God. Be spiritual. Do whatever you want. I have no problem with that. Right? I'm not one of those people that's like, some people say anti-theist. I mean, like, I don't believe it's true, but that's my own personal opinion. Someone else might believe it's true, and maybe it's good for them, right? I know some people that, you know, the religion helped them to give up many harmful practices, like you said, right? Mm-hmm. And mindfulness is actually a really interesting topic. I know you mentioned that a couple of times. Have you, like, you've probably gone way deeper into this topic, I'm sure, than I have. I've pretty much got two books I've read on mindfulness, and I found the idea extremely powerful. And I was hoping to make a video on it at some point. I made that one little video before I actually studied it. But after I studied it, I realized, like, this isn't what I thought it was. I thought, you know, meditation is more like, you know, trying to think about nothing. And I didn't realize that it's not about, you know, the more you try to not think, the more you're going to think. It's more about being in the moment. And you can make that moment for yourself wherever you are, you know, whether you're on the train or on the bus. You know, it's just being in the moment, right? And it's just, you can practice mindfulness even when you're eating. You can you know, enjoy your meal mindfully. And like you were saying, mindfulness has powerful effects in terms of healing, right? I almost feel like mindfulness could be the religion even for atheists, right? Like, because it gives you a lot of the benefits without the dogma, you know what I mean? Without having to believe in this God or whatever, you can actually see the benefits. And when people say that, you know, it's crazy because it challenges, you know, Islam says don't steal because God is going to punish you and because you want God to love you. It's an external reason. Mindfulness says be content with who you are, what you have, and you will find that bliss, that happiness, no matter what your situation. You become in charge of your own kind of fate, right? Like, is that a good way to describe, is that correct how I'm describing it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you touched on a lot of different important factors about mindfulness. One of the interesting things is that this is something that atheists can totally get into. Sam Harris is completely into it. He wrote a book on it. If you guys haven't read it, read his book. He studied the Eastern Dharmic traditions for 20 years of his life, and he's all about mindfulness. You know, it's funny because in the Buddha's time, mindfulness comes from the Dharmic traditions. The Hindu tradition passed on to Buddha, and Buddha made it, you know, made it his central practice. Vipassana is what we call it in Pali language. So the Buddha appealed to a lot of atheists, right? That's who he appealed to, right? He appealed, and to this day, he appeals to atheists.
And it's so funny that Islam, the Quran doesn't even mention atheism. There's no such thing as atheist in the Islamic in the Quranic worldview. It's like you're either a pagan or you're a Christian and Jew, people of the book, or Sabians, which is another dead religion that Allah decided to include in his holy book for all mankind, which nobody knows who Sabians. I mean, we know who it is, but they're like a dead religion. And it's so different, right? It's like it's a different perspective on life. Very different.
Definitely. And so with mindfulness, I would say, and meditation both, it's definitely about paying attention, dhyan karna, paying attention, noticing what's arising in the moment, the subtleties, the nuances of what's arising in the moment. See, paying attention to awareness itself.
And this is what I was surprised about. I thought mindfulness is all about like going into a trance, disconnecting mm-hmm. yourself from everything, not being in the moment. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is the opposite of what I thought it was.
Right. So So there are a certain degree. There's different techniques and mindfulness meditation, and there's other kinds of meditations. So, for example, transcendental meditation, which was popular in the '60s because of the Beatles and Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and Oprah and Ellen DeGeneres and Russell Brand and you know Russell Simmons, and the list could go on and on. Right? I actually took the transcendental meditation course. That's about going more so into that trance state, yeah. That samadhi state, that where you lose awareness of the body and the mind and reach the state of satchitananda, bliss, consciousness. But mindfulness is different. Mindfulness is the practice of being in the moment, being centered, cultivating an improved attention span, and that kind of thing. So yeah, I mean, mindfulness, both have had tremendous amount of studies, both TM and mindfulness, hundreds of studies, and with empirical results that show outstanding results in the area of depression, anxiety, health, and so on, brain structure, chemistry, and so on and so forth. So absolutely, there's practical benefits, and then there's healing benefits for the brain and the body. Actually silencing the mind and going into the trance too has benefits. And let me tell you what, because Sam Harris talks about this in his book. Harris, very, very briefly, Harris talks about this. He says that we're thinking constantly, even when we're sleeping, we're dreaming, right? Cortisol is being released when we're sleeping. And if we're thinking constantly, those thoughts take a toll on the body and the brain and the skeletal muscular system, tension, and so on and so forth. Meditation is the ability to quiet the mind and relieve you from that to one degree. That's not what the central purpose of meditation, but that's one of the many benefits that you get from it, is being in theta state. And so, yeah, there's many different benefits to meditation.
That's interesting, because I actually had a Muslim, you know, I went on this like mindfulness like rage on Facebook, posting things about mindfulness when I was reading the book, just sharing it, kind of like live tweeting in a sense. And one of the most, one of my Muslim friends is like, so is there any evidence for mindfulness, like any scientific evidence? He was kind of implying that, you know, you've just gone from one dogma to another. He wanted to kind of like poke at me. And it's so funny, but I'm like, yeah, there's like a lot of science behind this. It's proven to have health benefits. And someone's asking in the chat, maybe you can answer this. What's the difference between mindfulness and empathy? And empathy. Won't nature just get rid of or not prefer social outcasts?
Is it empathy?
Yeah, empathy and mindfulness. He wants to know what's the difference.
Okay, so yeah, empathy, there's a particular meditation that's targeted towards empathy, and that's called metta bhavana, or loving kindness, in Buddhist circles anyways. And so that is supposed to trigger the empathy part of the brain, and it's supposed to, but when you're focusing on loving kindness for say 20 minutes a day, 30 minutes a day, or what have you, you're cultivating empathy in a loving kindness meditation. Whereas mindfulness, you're cultivating a different, you're working out a different part of the brain, which deals with the attention span. So you're cultivating attention span to what's arising in the moment as it's arising. The basic example that I give is when I worked at a hospital in a hospital unit, one of the psychiatric patients went off and I was hit, all right? This is a common example that I give. This is a good example I always give, actually. So in that moment when I was hit by the psychiatric patient, there's a couple of things that happen. Heart starts racing fast, lungs start breathing faster, muscles get tense, thoughts and emotions are all over the place inside of the mind. And so in the moment, what I did when the patient hit me was I brought my attention to my heart racing fast. I brought my attention to my breathing that was going faster. Heart started to calm down, breathing started to calm down. Brought my attention to my muscles that were tense, muscles relaxed. Brought my attention to the thoughts that were arising, they subsided. And then I was, I don't like using the word control, but I'm just gonna use it for purpose of conversation. I was in control rather than my emotions being in control of me. Right. And so that's what mindfulness is all about, being in the moment and being able to emotionally regulate, being able to manage and navigate through thoughts and emotions and feelings and stimuli, external and internal. And so that's different than empathy, which is loving kindness, which is being able to relate to other people, connect with other people, feel for other people when they're hurt or angry or whatever. So that's the difference between the two.
And again, I just have to say, like, this was another thing that was mind-blowing to me. Mm. Coming from this paradigm of, you know, Prophet Muhammad says, whoever controls the anger, Allah will give, this must be for men only, Allah will let him choose from any of the Hurul Ain that he likes in Jannah. So, you know, anytime I wanted to control my anger, I'm like, just think about the Hurul Ain, just think about the Hurul Ain, just think about the Hurul. It's such a diff, it's such a childish perspective. Like, it's just, you laugh when you think about it now. It's like that's how you that's not how you motivate people. Like, that's such a childish way of motivating people. And it's like so mind-blowing when you come up with, like, when you look at mindfulness and you look at what you just said, that, you know, being in charge of your own self, being in charge of your body, being in charge of your mind, like, honestly, it blew my mind. I was like, dang, this is some like crazy stuff. And somebody just said in the chat, oh, it sounds like woo to me, like superstitious woo. No, listen to this. The most like skeptical materialistic people like Sam Harris are promoting mindfulness. How is it, where's the woo in that? Like, there's science behind this stuff. Like, you know, humanity, humans have figured out these things.
every major medical institution has not only done research but has applied mindfulness in their facilities. We're talking about Johns Hopkins, we're talking about Mayo Clinic, we're talking about Harvard. You can't name me a university that not only doesn't have a mindfulness program, but they teach it. Every psychology book that's been published, including the psychology book that I happen to be using right now, includes meditation and mindfulness and the research along with it. My thing is, you know, with regards to the woo-woo thing, here's the thing. I'm not gonna lie. I'm an agnostic, but I'm an agnostic theist. We're gonna get into that in a minute, just for conversation purposes.
Okay.
With regards to the woo-woo, because even Michael Shermer has gone back on that comment. You listen to his conversation with Deepak Chopra. He used to call his stuff woo-woo.
Yeah.
Listen to his latest conversation. He says, after doing a retreat, I've gone back on some of those comments. So it's because he's actually went and meditated and did yoga, right? Now, here's the thing. In terms of the atheist, listen, I could believe in woo-woo, but here's the thing. When it comes to, I want to make this position clear, right? There's atheists and materialists. There's Christians. There's Muslims. And then there's us, okay? You can put New Agers, Buddhists, Hindus, Native American people, everybody who values the indigenous cultures and where we've come from, you know, and has some type of metaphysical worldview. There, when you look at those four perspectives, I honestly have to ask skeptics, and maybe you can help me out too, Samir, do you believe in the Christian, do you think that the Christian narrative makes more sense, where a person had to be tortured on a cross 2,000 years ago? Do you believe in the Muslim narrative, where God sends down a revelation literally in the mind of Muhammad and now everybody has to follow it, otherwise God's going to punish you? Or do you believe in the narrative of these woo-woo people, including me, I don't take offense to it, that are open-minded, that are trying to make sense of their subjective experience, that we don't understand our subjective experience. There are structures within the subjective paradigm that occur that we don't have explanations for, and that we're open-minded to a metaphysical worldview that could, okay, we're agnostic here, could do justice to the to phenomenology, right? When you look at those three perspectives, how can you hate on us? You know what I mean? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I would definitely cross out, you know, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, as just, I mean, as at least a literal kind of view of it. Maybe the mystical view, you know, there's some value in that. I have a friend that's a perennialist.
And
I'm sorry?
I'm a perennialist as well.
Okay, there you go. So, you know, I don't discount people's personal experiences. I think that me personally, I think I'm a materialist and I reject dualism and, you know, the idea of a soul. But I do acknowledge that I do believe that, you know, deism is a valid position. And maybe there is some sort of, you know, alternate reality. I mean, we don't know. Like, I personally just incline towards atheism. I think that's materialist atheism, I should say. And so I think the only thing that exists is the material world and there's nothing outside it. But I'm not, like, dogmatic about it. So
you admit that we're both agnostic, though, right?
Yes. Yeah, I'm agnostic atheist. So I'm willing to change my position if after I research it. Maybe I will change my position one day. But as of now, I do believe that this material world is all that exists. It always existed, and it's just a chance that we're here. But if there's something else outside there, it's possible. I'm willing to acknowledge that there is a possibility of that as well.
So let me ask you this. Here's the thing. When I have conversations with people, it's not to convince them of what I believe. That is definitely never, ever the case. I always have conversations with people to kind of brainstorm, right? That's what I have conversations with. Now, Richard Dawkins, you know, when he was asked about atheism, he said that out of seven, he would rate himself 6 out of 7 in terms of how sure he is that God doesn't exist. And I would do the same with regards to my agnostic theism. I would be 6 out of 7 sure that God does exist. And by God, I don't mean the same thing as Abrahamic tradition. What I mean is consciousness, what I mean is energy, an all-pervasive reality that we don't understand yet. Can I make an absolute truth claim about that with objective evidence? No, right? So the classical arguments, Kalam cosmological argument for morality, fine-tuning and teleological arguments, those types of arguments, they, from my perspective, they don't necessarily, from a logical standpoint, necessarily prove the God's existence. What they do is they point towards legitimate evidence that should make a person think. And my problem with skeptics is that they're too dismissive of the Kalam cosmological argument. They're too dismissive of the fine-tuning theological argument. Even if it doesn't prove God's existence, it is a compelling argument worth considering. That's my perspective as an agnostic theist. Even though I can't make an absolute truth claim about it, you can't just dismiss the fine-tuning intelligent design like that. Not from my angle anymore.
Right.
My reason why I'm furthermore an agnostic theist is because, from the perspective of Swami Vivekananda, who came to America, he was a great Hindu Swami. He said that the previous religions were atheists because they did not believe in God outside of you, right? But the modern day atheist, the way the correct atheism is a person who does not believe in their own existence, right? So think Rene Descartes, I think, therefore I am, type of that type of existential questioning, or think Oracle of Delphi, know thyself, and you shall know the gods. You know, this is the perennial truth, right? It isn't seeking God outside of you; it's meditating, becoming acquainted with awareness itself, transcending the five senses, transcending logic, having that mystical experience. Not just everybody has their own degree of mystical experience. But for a lot of people who haven't had the mystical experience, you know, I can't blame them in terms of why they're materialistic. But people who have had the mystical experience, the skepticism seems foolish. Mm. At least to me, the mystical experience makes skepticism seem foolish. But that's effective.
Do you not think that we can explain mystical experiences just by pure brain science?
That's like saying we can explain everything through mechanism. We can. Mechanisms mean nothing. All it does is show the mechanism by which reality surfaces. It does not explain meaning. It does not explain qualia. It does not explain subjectivity. It does not explain any of the things that we're experiencing or find meaning for. And that doesn't mean that we jump to the other conclusion and do God of the gaps. That's not what I'm saying. Let's all admit we're agnostic, right? Let's all admit that. And then let's look at the evidence and see which one is more plausible. And what I would say is that the materialist arguments are not as plausible as the metaphysical arguments. And I would stand by that.
Right. And so I've been trying to find a way to have a discussion with a Muslim, and I'm failing miserably. Everyone that I ask to have a discussion refuses to discuss actually Islamic theology, and they want to stick to, you know, the topic of God, which I think, you know, it's much harder to kind of get to the bottom of. Mm-hmm. Like you said, there's some good arguments. I always understood, now again, I don't want to sound like an idiot because I'm not a philosopher, but I always understood that the problem with the Kalam cosmological argument, you know, which is everything that begins to exist has a cause, the universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. I always thought that the problem with that was that we don't know whether the rules of causality, which are empirical, would apply outside of the universe.
Exactly. And
yeah, and the thing is, metaphysics kind of gives an explanation for everything without God. The fact that, you know, particles can pop in and out of existence, supposedly without any cause, they just pop in and out of existence. It's possible that the universe itself was one of those particles that, you know, instead of disappearing, it actually stayed. And if the quantum form, you know, the reality outside of our current universe was, you know, which is what we see particles popping in and out of, that may have always existed. Now, I mean, how do we explain something always existing? Just like how do we explain God always existing? Yeah. So I kind of feel like science at that point is very rough still, and we're still trying to figure out a lot of details, but it does lend some weight to the hypothesis that maybe a universe just popped into existence, and through the kind of natural selection of universes, let's call it that, the one with the characteristic that would have, you know, stayed was our universe. And if there was other universes that didn't, you know, maybe there was like other universes that didn't survive, or that didn't end up with life inside them because of the different properties that each one had, right? You know what I'm saying? So that's how I kind of explain it. Mm-hmm. And in terms of fine tuning, Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, that's probably the biggest argument for theism, as far as I understand, is fine-tuning. And I don't mean fine-tuning of life, because evolution explains life very easily. I mean, and evolution shows that life is rough and nasty, you know, lions eating animal, you know, cheetahs and lions eating gazelle, and like insects, you know, that plant the parasites that plant the eggs inside other living creatures, and, you know, worms that eat the eyes of kids, of babies in Africa. Like, we don't see any sort of thought process or planning, you know, which is why, you know, the blind watchmaker analogy that Dawkins, I don't know if he came up with it or not, but it makes perfect sense that the watchmaker is blind. But if you want to talk about abiogenesis, or if you want to talk about even before that, the fine tuning of the universe, I mean, it's again, it's a philosophical argument, not a scientific argument. And I feel like it could go either way. Maybe there's a God that rolled the dice. But the problem I have with the fine tuning, or at least the response I heard to it, is that we don't know, again, we don't know whether each universe that was created has equal probability for each of the characteristic attributes that we look at. Like when we talk about the weak nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, you know, all of these constants, that where did these constants come from? The speed of light, like why is it what it is, right? We don't know whether when the dice is rolled for a universe to be created, whether they all have equal probability or not. Like, you know what I'm saying? We don't know what the range is on the dials. And this is all very, very theoretical, which is why, you know, when I had a few Muslims, actually I had one guy that told me, he was begging me for a debate. And finally, when I agreed to debate him, he said, I only want to talk about God. And I said, I don't kind of see the point, because it comes down to, you know, very abstract philosophy and logic, and I don't think most people can really understand. It's at a totally different level, like up there somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, that's
Abdul. I think that Muslims and Christians try to prove God's existence to people in order to convert them. I think that here's the thing. I think that that's an important discussion, but it doesn't prove Islam or Christianity be true, right? Because here you have a Hindu claiming the same thing. Now what do we do?
Exactly.
And what the Muslims and Christians try to do is they think that they can get you to consider how amazing reality is, which you probably already see reality is freaking amazing, regardless of whether you're an atheist or a theist. And so because reality is so compelling and amazing, they have a point for you to consider, even though there's no empirical measurable evidence for the existence of God, you know, it's still a compelling argument. And now somehow you should consider Islam and Christianity because they have the biggest populations. They did the most colonizing, right? They did the most imperialism. And so, and now, you know, therefore Islam must be true because it makes more sense than the Trinity. And this way of reasoning, it doesn't make any sense. Let me, and I think that atheists and skeptics will appreciate what I'm about to say here. Swami Chinmayananda, another Hindu Swami, he was given a question to explain how this is supposed to work from our perspective. He said, who is the author of physics? He asked the question, who is the author of physics? Obviously, there isn't an author of physics. There's different scientists who at different times did different calculations and developed different experiments and different theories, and they all contributed to our collective knowledge, and we are where we are. Likewise, what Swami Chinmayananda explained was that there were different people throughout the world and throughout history and throughout India that were having mystical experiences, documenting their mystical experiences, explaining them and storytelling and philosophizing about them. And collectively, they're contributing to our knowledge about the subjective experience as in the relationship between consciousness and physics. The relationship between consciousness and physics from a scientific standpoint is a mystery. We don't know how consciousness and physics relate to each other and how one impacts the other and whether they're co-arising or whether there's an emergence, right? I tend to believe that there's no, the emergent theory, I don't believe in. I believe that they're co-arising. And I believe in monism. You believe in material monism. I believe that there's a metaphysical and physical monism that's there. So, but my point is that, you know, with regards to even what you were saying, the quantum foam and all that, we don't know what's outside of time and space. We don't know what's outside of time and space. There's time is different in different parts of the universe. So, you know, this argument in terms of cause and effect, the cosmological argument, we can, since we cannot say what's outside of time and space, we cannot say that God has a cause. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because
God,
no space,
I mean, God is the
causality. Right. So God would be a constant, exactly. And again, he, unfortunately, when we say, and Hindus have this problem, Buddhists have this problem too, bro. When we say God, we imagine the Abrahamic God. We imagine this anthropomorphic masculine figure. And Hindus get on me all the time. Stop saying God, right? Believe me, a lot of Hindus get on me. Stop saying God. But, I mean, like, you know, if you go, and then if I say energy, it's all woo-woo, it's all new agey. If I say consciousness, that's new agey. And my thing is, you know, quit with these labels, quit with like pretending like you know what's going on.
Yeah.
And let's have a conversation and brainstorm reality. We're both agnostic.
Yeah.
You know,
and let's, can you touch about, like, you know, the difference between, you know, Hinduism, Buddhism, and these philosophies versus Islam, you know, Judaism and Christianity, and this idea of like revelation. And, you know, the difference between how, you know, they came up with, how did, you know, how did Hindu philosophers come up with what they believe versus, like, you know, revelation in Islam?
Sure. So they developed what they would view as a science. If the science is that there's a hypothesis, then there's the experiment, and then there's the results. So the hypothesis was, if you apply these yogic technologies, these yogic techniques, these meditation techniques, these practical techniques, that you're going to get results. And those results are subjective, okay? They're not objective, they are subjective. But the idea was, this is a methodology, apply it, see what happens, come to your own conclusions. Same thing when I was talking about, say, Swami Chinmayananda, who was the author of physics, right? That, there is no author. So same thing with mysticism, there is no author of Hinduism, there is no author of some religion. Mystics or have been having these experiences. You can read William James, one of the greatest philosophers of all time, one of the greatest psychologists of all time. Read his book, The Variety of Religious Experiences. There's so many other books that we can mention that get into this. I'm not going to go into the variety of religious experiences, but there's an aspect to subjectivity that is interesting. And when you have the mystical experience, it's mind-boggling. Ask Sam Harris. He'll tell you about it, how mind-boggling it is. And it's not like a normal day-to-day experience. It's definitely enhanced, it's heightened, it's mind-boggling, to say the least. And so, but does that mean that we can come up with some type of deductive conclusion? No, we can't make any truth claim, but that doesn't mean any. Just because we can't make a truth claim doesn't mean that it's not compelling evidence for a possibility, right? And so the difference between Hinduism and Buddhism as a philosophy to Hinduism is simply that there are no doctrines. Nobody's telling you to believe in anything. Nobody's telling you that you have to subscribe to, you know, X, Y, and Z.
But can you clarify for me, like, doesn't Hinduism come with dogma as well? Like what about the caste system? What about the idea, the practice of sati, of wife burning? And what about, like, you know, isn't there, like, dogma as well in Hinduism? Like,
So dogma is inevitable. Just like we're trying to transcend ego, the ego is inevitable. We're trying to transcend beliefs, but beliefs are inevitable. We're trying to transcend dogma. Dogma is inevitable. So even an atheist who subscribes to nothing has beliefs and propositions that they descend to. That's dogma, right? So we want to go beyond dogma and transcend it, but dogma is inevitable. So does Hinduism have dogma? Here's what I would say to that question. The mystics of India said that this is what we experienced and this is what we saw. And this is our interpretation of what we saw, okay? In our experience, our outer body experience, mystical experiences. They don't even have to be mystical. They could be practical, regular experiences. And it could be insight, just vipassana, insight, right? That arises. It doesn't have to be full-blown mystical experience where you're having these visions, fantastical visions of angels and stuff like that, afterlife. They don't have to be. Many mystics just have practical experiences with insight pertaining to the practical circumstance. So here's the thing, the other thing, Hinduism is thousands of years old, right? Thousands of years older than Judaism, right? Think about Egypt, Egyptology, the indigenous religions, Amazon, Native Americans. And so what Hindus have always embraced is our evolution. We embrace our evolution. We see that humanity is evolving. We're evolving in our knowledge, in our consciousness, and so on and so forth. So back then, in that context, when you know, what were Arabs doing 3,000 years ago, right? What were Europeans doing 4,000? What kind of practices did they have? You know, talk about sati and all these types of things. You're muted, Abdullah. I didn't hear you.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, there was a lot of terrible, harmful practices that were the existing back then.
Arabs were burying their daughters, right? That was only 100 years ago.
Yeah.
You're talking about, you're wondering what Indians were doing 4,000 years ago.
Right. I think the issue is when we try to bring those things into the modern world, not necessarily, yeah, I mean, I can make excuses for people doing those things back then, but the problem is just like with Muslims, when they want to bring, you know, child marriage into today's world, because they say that, well, if Muhammad married a 9 or 6 year old, then it's okay to marry a child, right?
We believe in evolution. We allow evolution.
Okay.
All of the Sunnis talk about that.
Yeah.
They talk about it. Evolution is happening. If you don't change your perspective,
yeah.
Don't evolve with the time and the information that's coming in, then your religion is obsolete. You are a fundamental.
So you're telling me bid'ah is good?
It's wonderful.
Bid'ah hasana. So we'll take the Sufi approach. Bid'ah hasana. Kullu bid'ah hasana. Everything is good bid'ah. Unfortunately, with Islam, and that's kind of the challenge with reforming it, is you have statements like kullu bid'ah dalal. Right? Every bid'ah is misguidance. With Sufi, somehow, you know, they excuse that statement or they reinterpret it somehow. But yeah, okay, that's good. That's good perspective. If religion can mutate, evolve, improve, I mean, fantastic. That's good news.
It has, and it is,
yeah.
Right? From a perspective science, when the original physicists were doing their experiments, we didn't know. We know more now. The mystics have been doing they have had their experiences. We're still agnostic, but we have a better understanding. We're getting all of this together and making sense of it. Now, and you made a good point. Is it just mechanism in the brain? Everything that you experience is mechanism in the brain. The colors, the meaning, your relationships, everything is mechanism in the brain. You can't just reduce. If you reduce your experiences, anything that you call meaningful and qualitative, even the taste of good food, the intimacy with your wife, if you want to dismiss that as just mechanism and brain chemistry, go for it. I'm for all of the mechanisms. I've studied the mechanisms, right? I love science. And I'm not a person to make absolute truth claims. The gnosis that I claim is a subjective gnosis. It is not an objective knowledge. That's where we're at.
Okay. I mean, this has been a great conversation, and I'm so happy that we had it. And thank you for, you know, arranging to make this happen. Apologize for people that were going to tune in tomorrow. We had a little misunderstanding about the day, so we had it one day early. But you can still catch the recorded video. And Farhan, do you want to just share your social media, how people can follow you or reach you online?
Yeah, sure. I mean, basically, it's YouTube for me. My username happens to be Orthodox. From the days when I was Sunni and Muslim, that's what the word Orthodox means. Also, 76 comes from. So, but I never changed my username. My concluding remarks is that I embrace atheists, I embrace agnostics and skeptics. I'm not trying to convert anybody or get you guys to believe what I believe. I love brainstorming. I love brainstorming and thinking about the nature of reality. And I think that we need more individuals who are atheists to stand up for knowledge and stand up for, because ex-Muslims, there's an ex-Muslim in the contact. What are you guys doing to help ex-Muslims? They need us. There are people who are gravitating towards atheism and whatnot. They need to hear your voice, Abdullah. There are people who are spiritual but not religious or thinking about mysticism. My voice could help them. It's traumatic to leave Islam. And that's where he's for people who are traumatized.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I haven't deep dived into it as much as you, but I do feel that there's much benefit in spirituality as well, especially mindfulness. That's the one thing I did look into. And I encourage all of your viewers to get a book on mindfulness. There's a bunch of them. If you have Audible, I actually like Audible because it allows me to digest a lot of content without having to sit down and read it. You can just put on my headphones, go for a walk and try to digest some of the material. And I do want to encourage everyone to check out Farhan's channel, Orthodox 786, and you know, it might be helpful to you if you're looking for something. You know, if you left Islam and you have a hole in your heart and you're looking for a way to fill it, maybe you need some sort of spirituality. And, you know, I support Farhan, and I support, like I said, I believe that the world would be a better place as long as everyone, you know, we should support other people that are, you know, trying to make a world a better place. And that includes Farhan, you know, even if you don't necessarily agree with the same conclusions. I mean, this is how we improve the world. We all share our perspectives, and we have dialogues, and we have discussions. And this is only the second discussion I'm having online, but I'm happy this is a good trend now. So, okay, thank you, Farhan. Again, it's youtube.com/orthodox786. And looking forward to having another discussion with you in the future.
Thank you, Abdullah. I appreciate you so much. Keep going, brother. And it's good to see genuine, real ex-Muslims. Real.
All right. Okay.